Hello, and welcome to the Personal Wealth Coach. Jake McClure here, and I'm going to be flying solo again today. This episode, we have some extremely exciting, if you like this program anyway, subjects to talk about. We've got a couple of questions from Inquisitor John. The first one is talking about the auction results for the treasury auctions, bonds, bills, notes, all that good stuff, and some information about it. It's kind of interesting. The second question is about a new move, new-ish move, to implement a thing that should have been implemented a long time ago, which is treating retirement money from retirement accounts at a workplace that have rolled over into an IRA in the best interest of the person that owns them. There's a law that's been on the book there for a long time, and so we'll delve into that for a little bit. We'll be back on the other side of the bumper music with more. Welcome back to the Personal Wealth Coach with Jake McClure. I'm going to speed through our disclosures. Number one, the Personal Wealth Coach is also the name of an SEC-registered investment advisory firm. Just because the firm's registered with the SEC doesn't mean that the SEC particularly cares one way or another about our expertise or anything else. It's not implying that. They're just the regulatory organization. Number two, we're registered to give investment advice, which we can't do on a podcast for lots of reasons. So we're giving education instead. This hopefully should be worthwhile, if not boring, maybe both, maybe worthless and very interesting. So you could swap it back and forth or some combination of all four. Also, the information that we're giving is coming from places that we deem to be reliable. We're definitely not going to guarantee that it's correct from their perspective, but we're getting it from reputable sources. All right, so I'm going to jump into this. The first statement, Inquisitor John sent a question and said, and he's got the auction results from the Wall Street Journal for the Treasury auction, U.S. Treasury auction. What is a treasury? People throw the treasury market. Well, treasury sounds like a vault somewhere or something like that. It's the Treasury Department doing an auction through a third party as the auctioneer to sell loans to itself. So it's going out and saying, who wants to loan us money? And we're going to take bids for all those who want to loan us money. It's a very organized function. They do a lot of work to keep it regulated and organized. Here's the deal. You would think with the amount of debt that the United States has that people would be a little leery about loaning us money. That's not the case. And this is John's statement. He says, I just saw this the auction results for the first time today. They're in the Wall Street Journal pretty regularly, but they are back in the back and you look at it and it says auction results and people think maybe it's an ad, it's in a different format than the rest of the paper. And what he's saying is with applications far exceeding accepted bids, it seems U.S. debt is still widely preferred. What does that mean? It means that we have more people trying to loan the United States government money than the government has the ability or the want to spend. That's kind of a flip from people when we talk about the government spends a lot more than it earns. Tax revenue is not enough to cover all of the budget. So we're borrowing a bunch of money and we're borrowing so much. And at some point, something's going to happen and people will stop borrowing. But we have applications to bid at this last auction of about $183 billion. They could only accept just under $70 billion. So there's $110 billion that really wanted to get loaned to the government, and it didn't. It's an interesting result. Why is that? Why is it with the amount of debt that we have? And we have more debt than any other single entity on the planet. It's not necessarily horribly unhealthy for the country right now, but it could get that way relatively quickly if we're not careful. It's definitely not something I would say is healthy. I wouldn't say it's horribly unhealthy either. There's a lot of quibbling that can go on here. Debt is important to our society across the board. If you want to build a house rather than pay it all out of pocket, which would remove the vast majority of people that want to buy a house, spreading the debt out over a 30-year period for something that you're going to use during that 30-year period is a reasonable and rational thing to do. It's a healthy approach. If we're building roads that are going to get used for the next 15 years, we should, if we're going to borrow money to do it, we should have a bond that's paid off during the life of the road, the 15-year period. Just side note, the word mortgage refers to life expectancy. In Latin, the word mort means death. And gauge is a measurement. So death measurement, life expectancy. If you don't put any additional money into a house over a 30-year period, you don't fix the roof, you don't replace the carpet, you don't retile, you don't fix any plumbing, you just keep it. At the end of the 30-year period, the house itself is valueless. It may cost you money to have it knocked down and have something built in its place. So even the word mortgage comes from the concept of paying for it as you use it. Now, you're paying more than you would if you bought it all up front, because you've got to pay the interest to somebody along the way. But it's reasonable if you don't have all the money up front and you want to actually live in a house. It's nowhere near as expensive as renting the thing over a 30-year period. You get nothing left after that, not even the value of the land underneath it. And hopefully you're putting some upkeep back into the rental or you're not going to want to live there. So looking at debt for the United States, so long as it's not like a credit card where you're just eating out and spreading the debt over the next 5 to 10 years for your food today, consumption debt's not good. And we've got some of that going on in the United States. But if you look at our defense spending is a long-term investment. Some of it is going to salaries. There's a little bit of consumption there. But if we're buying new equipment or researching the ability to make new and better equipment, that's a long-term investment. It makes sense to have debt associated with that. It doesn't make sense to have debt associated with Medicare. That's consumption. We're spending it right now and spreading the debt over a 30-year period. When we look at our ratio of consumption to long-term investment style spending in the government, it's about half and half. So we have more unhealthy debt than healthy debt. This is where I talk about the quibbling. However, most governments have it worse. As bad as it is for me to say this, because it makes it sound like I love the debt of the United States or something. It isn't that. Most governments are doing it not as well as we are, which is weird because we're not doing it particularly well. It's kind of the old saying, democracy is the worst form of government on the planet, except for all of the others. And that's the truth. So why is it that people are bidding to buy U.S. government treasuries? And the answer is because we're the safest place on the planet. The Ukraine-Israel defense aid bill was just passed, and it was a big deal in Israel. It was a big deal in Russia and in Ukraine. Why? Because we have the best stuff on the planet when it comes to defense. We also have the best stuff on the planet when it comes to the products that we generally make, whether that's software or hardware. America is known as quality. And it's really a castle on a hill in most people's expectations. They treat us mythically in Ukraine. They look at what we send over there as magic. And I mean, they understand it to some extent, but they couldn't recreate it. And that is one of the big things that's going on here. So as long as we represent the highest quality on the planet, people are willing to give us loans. This is going to be the case until we stop being quality. That is just the reality of any debt. If you are a for-profit enterprise that is making something that everybody wants and your profit margins are good and the quality of what you're putting out is fantastic, profit margins being GDP for us, best in the planet, on the planet by far, then people want to loan money to you. It's like the best bet they can make, especially if you're paying a decent interest rate. So our auctions are overbid almost constantly. We had one auction that wasn't overbid, and I did several episodes, both of the radio program and the podcast on that. And that had to do with a Russian hack of a Chinese bank to try to make us have worse relations with China because Russia wanted China to come be their buddy more. So just, you can look back for that in the podcast. It's worth checking out. Okay, next question. And this one is more, it's nearer and dearer to my heart than almost any question out there. There was an article in the Wall Street Journal yesterday. The title of the article was "Advisors on Trillions in IRAs Must Now Put Your Interest First." Inquisitor John, who is our most faithful and loyal questioner, has this question: why will this version prevail when others have failed? What are we talking about here? Back in 2006, an act was passed under a Republican Congress called the Pension Protection Act of 2006, the PPA. And in it, it said that the Labor Department needed to propose rules and then enact them to ensure that people giving advice on retirement assets did it in the best interest of the person that was receiving the advice. That seems reasonable. In a 401k or a 403b, you are only allowed to receive advice at the fiduciary level. Fiduciary. What does that mean? It's Latin. Fiduciary, fido. It means loyalty. It's a duty. It's an obligation. There's a one-word English translation, steward. Someone whose sole obligation is to work for the person that they're working for, to work in their interest and not in their in for self-serving purposes. Now, they're expected to get paid. This isn't a job that people would do for free, but it needs to be reasonable and it needs to be talked about with the person that's paying them. Now, we're here at the Personal Wealth Coach. We are extremely prejudiced on the subject because we're functioning as fiduciaries across the board. That's just the way we're going to do it. That means that we need to fully disclose all our fees, all our conflicts of interest, any way we can be compensated. Even if you're not compensating us that way, we need to tell you about it. And I think that's a pretty baseline common sense approach. Everybody should do this with their finances. But that's not the way the vast majority of the investment world is structured. The vast majority of the investment world is structured in this kind of a flashy, sexy, you know what you're doing. And so you know if somebody's giving you advice to double check them and you need to make sure that the person telling you what to do, if they're not pulling one over on you. And it's in all the movies. It's The Wolf of Wall Street. Any movie about the stock market, you have this buyer beware concept. And the people that are scammed are told by the scammers, hey, you should have looked. This is caveat emptor. You need to look what you're doing. You should have known better. Well, the reality is that something over 90% of people that go to an investment person believe that they're dealing with someone who's working in their best interest. The College for Financial Planning Board just put out that research. The vast majority of people believe that whomever is giving them advice on their finances is doing it in their best interest. They're not obligated in most cases to tell you what they're getting paid by you. I mean, it's being paid by you to a company and then a company is paying them some portion of it. But they're not obligated to tell you except to tell you to read a prospectus what that number is. Where a fiduciary is a direct employee, and I hope you don't hire somebody to mow your lawn, have them do it, and then give them a blank check and hope that they're working in your best interest. Even if it's a great lawnmower, maybe they're fantastic at taking care of your grass. I would hope you would at least establish the guidelines on how much the pay is in advance. And that's kind of a fiduciary situation in the investment world. If you don't know what you're paying the person that's advising you, by definition, you're not working with a fiduciary. If you have a 401k or a 403b or a lot of the other number letter combinations at work plans, anyone that gives you advice on that is required by law to give you advice in your best interest to get rid of any conflicts and to tell you how much they're being paid up front and very clearly. As soon as that money moves out of a 401k, 403b letter number soup and into an individual retirement account, up till now, and even now at this point, the rule's not in effect. Anybody can give you any advice they want, regardless of who is benefiting more. They're not required to tell you how much they're getting paid. There's a whole group of people that are acting in a completely different manner than another group of people. So if you're going to an insurance agent, and this isn't me trying to beat up on insurance agents, we need insurance in the world. But insurance products, annuities, variable annuities, things like that, have much higher commission caps. They can get paid a lot more than if you go to someone who's regulated somehow under the Securities and Exchange Commission. A pure insurance person who's doing fixed annuities, there are commissions in the double-digit percentages and long, long, long surrender charge periods and a lot of stuff that you could say, what benefit am I getting out of it? It might be appropriate for you, but usually those commission rates are not. In a 401k, it's illegal to charge a commission. Well, what's this law? What is it that says this? What is the law that says you're not allowed to charge a commission on these things? It's called ERISA, the Employee Retirement Income Security Act of 1974. It's been around a while, and it was added to in the Pension Protection Act of 2006. If the Pension Protection Act were a person, it would be able to vote in this election. It's 18 years old, and the Labor Department has proposed 9 different sets of rules on the fiduciary level to require stockbrokers and financial advisors and investment professionals and coaches and everybody else to act as fiduciaries on this, because the law says we've got to make rules to make them do it. Every time the proposal comes forward and the Labor Department says, this is it, the lawsuits start coming in and the lobbying efforts start coming in. Who's paying for it? Well, the people who are going to lose money if it goes into effect. The major brokerage houses make the lion's share of their money dealing with retirement money, IRAs. This rule isn't even about your standard IRA where you're just putting in however much the $7,000 or the $8,500 max that you're allowed to do in the year. That's not covered. It only is going to be covered on a rollover IRA that came from a retirement plan at a work somewhere. I find that preposterous. I think retirement money is retirement money, and it should be treated in your best interest, period. So John's question is, why will this version prepare when it prevail when others haven't? And in the article itself, it says there might be another wave of lawsuits to block the effort. And I will go into it and say that's not a maybe. It is a positive. It will absolutely occur. As soon as the rule goes into effect, the lawsuits will begin. Why? Well, there are some decent arguments. The first and easiest argument to be made here is, what if you only have $10,000 in your IRA that came from a 401k? Well, fiduciaries can't make a living on you. You don't have enough money. If they charge you 1%, they might be able to talk to you one time and that's it. If they charge you more than that, then it's worse than or just as bad as the commission rates. So the level of regulatory requirement to meet the rules of being a fiduciary are very high. They require a lot of hours every year just to stay within the guidelines of registration. I can tell you that without any qualms that the forms that are required to maintain a fiduciary status with the federal government take a lot of time every year to maintain and refile. This is not in question. It is a major expense. So who's going to help the people that have smaller accounts? That's a valid argument. I think that it's possible to structure these accounts so that people can get paid and still be a fiduciary, but it's going to require completely different methodology and structure for pay, a different approach to how it's done from one end to the other. Who's and if the other side of the lawsuits is that if there's a stockbroker, a financial advisor who's got a certain amount of money that they are telling people what to do with. They're technically not giving ongoing advice on it because there's a best interest rule that says that ongoing advice falls under fiduciary categories too. So if you're only getting sporadic based on a trade type advice from someone, that's generally not a fiduciary. If that person has been in business for 27 years and they've been selling products and that's their bread and butter, it's the only way they get to survive, and the U.S. government passes a regulation that says, hey, you can't do that anymore, basically shuts their business down unless they go back to school and learn how to be a fiduciary. And it's not an easy task. You've got a lot of extra tests that you have to pass, and you have required learning in a lot of cases with a lot of hours involved in keeping that up to date. It's possible to be a fiduciary with only doing some front-end education, but the vast majority of fiduciaries have ongoing educational requirements that far exceed what a salesperson, a stockbroker, or a financial advisor has to do on their continuing education. So who's going to take care of these people? Who's going to take care of the entire book of business of this stockbroker who is trusted and ethical? This is the bottom line. Salespeople don't, just because they're selling things doesn't mean that they're unethical. The absolute majority of people in the investment world have a code of ethics that they follow and they mean it. And yes, they get paid and they'll have conversations with you about their pay if you get them to, if you ask them about it. Something usually with some guilt involved, but it's there. They really want to help the people that they're dealing with. And when the government comes along and says 90%+ of the people in the investment world who at least 60% of their income comes from retirement accounts, hey, you can't do that anymore. Expect the lawsuits. It's going to happen. Now, is it a good idea to do this? Will it protect the public? Will it make sure that people who have no idea what they're doing with their investments have some degree of idea that somebody's going to walk them through it and not be trying to pull the wool over their eyes the whole time, or not in the ethical way trying to unpull the wool? Because the standard right now is read the prospectus before investing. Well, read the prospectus. This prospectus is wool. I mean, you can't see through that thing unless you go to school to learn how to read it. I read those things on a regular basis, and sometimes they stump me. I find problems in prospectuses for mutual funds that are obvious to me, and I call up the mutual fund and they say, oh, we'll get that fixed. Well, what is it? Well, their performance number's incorrect, or they have a word that means something else being applied to the wrong thing. Their marketing department got too involved in the regulatory wording. It's a tough question. It's near to my heart because I believe that you should be dealing with a fiduciary across the board on your investments, period. Just anytime you're talking to somebody who's getting paid and giving you advice on what you're doing with your money, that you should be talking to somebody who's working in your best interest. It's sort of like going to a doctor. When you go to a doctor, you should expect them to only recommend surgery when you need it, not because they need to pay for their new Ferrari. That's not something that pops into your head when the doctor says, I'm sorry, ma'am, this is very serious. We're going to have to operate. You shouldn't have to wonder if he's paying for a second mortgage and that's why he's operating, or she. The same is very directly said in the investment world. If an investment person says, you need to move this money out of the 401k and into an IRA, and you need to do it just as soon as you separate from service, because there's all kinds of dangers associated with it. Well, number one, as soon as they say there's dangers associated with your 401k, you should be leery. But quite often, it is in your best interest to be in an IRA rather than a 401k. You should know how much you're paying for the thing you're buying, though. When you go to a car lot to buy a car, you should have an expectation that they're not going to give you the best price that's possible unless you haggle for it. There's a whole series of different companies that are trying the approach of haggle-free, and you can just trust that our prices are right, whether it's CarMax or Carvana. Carvana's got a lot of egg on its face right now because they've got lots of lawsuits. They haven't been on the up and up. They were trying to be the clean one. You can look at their reviews. When more than a third of your reviews are one star, that's not a fiduciary organization. So having said that, you should still expect on any car lot to be talking to somebody who's going to get paid and they don't want you to know how much. The same is true if you're replacing a roof. If you're a general contractor and you're replacing the roof and it's on your own house, then you know exactly who's getting paid what and what the prices are for labor and everything else. What's the markup for profit? What's the profit margin? You can tell that. If you're just the homeowner, you don't get to know that. You don't know if their bid is two times the price that it needs to be in order to do what you need to get done and for them to still have some profit. When it comes to your investments, most people don't go into those conversations with their investment professional armed with the right information. They just don't. So why will this version prevail when the others didn't? When the others have failed? I don't know that it will. It's being wrapped up in a different wrapper this time around. Joe Biden's got this junk fee crackdown that he's been going on, and it's across a lot of things. It's, you know, spam calls on your phone and people scamming the elderly and investment fees in retirement accounts. Like him or not, this isn't about Joe Biden. Like him or not, it's not about Donald Trump. It's not about Barack Obama. It wasn't about George W. Bush. These are all the presidents that during their administrations, the Labor Department proposed rules. I'm going to tell you something. I'm going to tell it as clearly as I can. None of those presidents were in any way involved in the creation of the rules. The Labor Department was given the task by Congress to create the rules, to say this is how we're being a fiduciary. Now, at the end of it all, if a president whose administration it happened to be at that moment said, I don't like this rule, redo it, that's something that has happened. But the vast majority of this is done by bureaucrats trying to follow a law that's 18 years old this year. And I think it's kind of preposterous that we're in a place where the tail is wagging the dog here. There's a lot of money at stake in this. And the Labor Department is coming at it in the typical bureaucratic fashion. You've heard us talk about the Bureau of Labor Statistics and so on. This is the Labor Department. Their job isn't to be popular. It isn't to be flamboyant or flashy or any of that. Their job is to continue to make sure that rules are followed that have been set by Congress and directed by a president. I hope that this rule will get passed and will not get swamped by the deluge of lawsuits and lobbies. Because again, if it's the lion's share of each of the major brokerage firms, this includes Robinhood, it includes E-Trade, it includes TD Ameritrade, it includes AG Edwards and Edward Jones and all the others. This is the lion's share of the investment world. Why? Because at your workplace, if they've been putting money in and you've been putting in, it's usually more than when you're putting in money by yourself. And that tends to be the greatest piece of your portfolio. It's the part that's leading to your hope for income in the future. The reason why the Labor Department is proposing this, the reason why there's special rules around IRAs and the retirement plans, rules like in bankruptcy, a lot of times it can't be taken. There's different caps on different kinds of accounts for liability. If you get in a car accident or you're a doctor performing a surgery and you get sued for it, there's certain parts of your assets they can't touch. Why? Because your 401k, which later hopefully turns into something that you're managing, an IRA of some kind, it represents your future income. In essence, it's your job. And they shouldn't allow people to sue you out of a job. Now, if the money was stolen, that's a different matter. But if you've been doing your duty to put money away for your retirement, that's your future job. That is your payroll. And you can't sue people to take their future pay. You can get their income some portion of it sent to you if they've done something horrible, but you can't say your job is not yours. And they can get fired for doing things, but not if they're self-employed. And that's what these retirement plans really represent, self-employed financial independence. It's not just an asset. It's supposed to represent the income that's associated with that asset. I realize I'm pushing on this a lot. It's near and dear to me because that CFP board survey that said 90%+ of people think that they're dealing with someone who's looking out for their best interest, when it's the flip side, only about 10%, less than that, are functioning as fiduciaries in the investment world. That is a huge difference. I don't believe that that should be the case. I think that if the marketplace isn't educated to know that they need to be their own advocates and they need to question everything, and they believe that they're working for somebody or with someone who's giving them the absolute best advice possible for them. You know, here's an example. There's different share classes in a mutual fund. It's the same portfolio underneath it. The share class just represents how expensive it is to be in that mutual fund. And if a broker, a financial advisor, has two choices and one will pay them more than the other one, which do you think they will take? This isn't unethical. If you have two jobs being offered to you and one will pay you more and you'll be proud of either job that you take, but one gives you a higher salary, which one are you going to take? That's the thought process in most financial advisors. They're doing something that they're proud of. They believe that they are offering you advice that is really good for you, and they get paid. That sounds like a perfect job. As a fiduciary, I have to give advice that says we've got to find the lowest cost we possibly can for this portfolio, for this client. There's limitations. A lot of times a mutual fund will say you have to have X amount of dollars before this expense ratio is available. But that's negotiable. And that's something that most investment folks don't know. And most investment customers absolutely don't know. So I beat this one quite a bit. I think it's worth knowing about this. It's worth knowing that you have a choice here, and it's an important choice when it comes to selecting who's giving you advice. It's not even supposed to be called advice when it's coming from somebody that's not a fiduciary. Often it'll be advice associated with a single sale. That is not a fiduciary. I think I've kind of covered the bases here. If you would like to talk to us off the air here as a fiduciary, I know I'm tooting our own horn here this episode, but I'm really prejudiced on the subject. We have voicemail during the weekend and real live people during the week. The local number is 254-947-1111. You can reach us toll-free should you still have a landline at 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. Our website is www.tpwc.com. That's thepersonalwealthcoach.com. There's contact forms there. You can read our newsletter there, sign up for it. You can listen to podcasts there or anywhere else you find podcasts. It's kind of like me sending you an electronic consent form electronically. I'm telling you on the podcast where you can find the podcast. You're listening to one right now. But you can also listen to our radio programs in its retired state, going back a lot of years to find out what we were saying at different times in history to see how right or wrong we were. We don't make a lot of predictions. The future is just not what it used to be. That's Yogi Berra, by the way. I didn't make that one up. So thanks for listening. I appreciate you guys, you gals, more than I can possibly say. Continually are shocked and surprised when people come up and say, I recognize your voice. I've been listening to you for a decade or two decades, or I'm sorry. That's my usual response. I hope you're medicated. That's all I got to say about that. Until next episode, this has been The Personal Wealth Coach.